Thank you so much for being here with us in South Dakota. Have you ever been to South Dakota?
I've been to North Dakota. I'm not sure I've been to South Dakota.
All right. I want to talk about hashtag YOLIN365. Let's start there because your 365th book comes out this year, followed by more. And it's time to celebrate. Do you celebrate with, what do you celebrate and how do you celebrate in your life as a writer?
The celebrations are always paragraph finished, you know, book finished, poem finished, and then if you sell a book or a poem or a short story or a verse novel or whatever it is, that's great. But that's only the beginning. All of those are beginnings. It's when the book comes out or the magazine with your poem in it comes out, that's when you really celebrate.
How do you celebrate?
Well, after 365, it's not a whole lot of jumping up and down and screaming and shouting. But it is, if a book comes in a big box, I take it and I hold it to my breast and then I smell it and then I fondle it. I don't read it for about 6 weeks.
Really?
Because I'll find a mistake. You always find a mistake somewhere in a book. Poems, not so much, but sometimes, because they're short. But somewhere, someone made a mistake, and it ruins your whole enjoyment and celebration if you find it. Best not to find it for 6 weeks.
Even a picture book, would you find?
You can find a typo. You can find the back matter is wrong, or the back cover is wrong, or the front cover is wrong, or a sentence that goes the, but they're on two different, you know, one ends the line and another starts the line. And it's almost impossible to figure out where that mistake came in. See, it's just not worth spoiling it.
What are you doing this year, because it's special, to sort of look back and say, well, the 365th book is not going to happen again. There's the hashtag.
No, but I'm looking at 400.
Right? Oh, you're already looking
at.
Right.
We had a huge party, a two-day party, at the Eric Carle Museum, which is in Amherst, Massachusetts. Picture book. It's a a museum of picture book art. And the first day, I gave a talk to people and children. Then there was a party for friends, relatives, writers, and illustrators that I knew who were close enough to come, and a number of industry people came up from New York and from Boston. To make the visit. So that was wonderful. And then five of my editors and six of my writers' groups each gave a little speech, which was a little embarrassing. but you know, as we said, it just the 365 only happens once ever. And then the next day, my daughter and I did an onstage. She did a she's also a children's book writer. She interviewed me on stage in front of 170 teachers and librarians.
Wow.
So that was, you know, that was exciting. And then we had a huge, big signing, and the Eric Carle Museum was delighted because we sold so many books. But there have been little celebrations. I mean, I've been doing readings. I've been doing book signings at libraries and at bookstores and that sort of thing. And that's ongoing. We're off to a book festival next weekend, and a couple of bookstores, a synagogue to sign a book with Jewish material in it. So a lot of stuff is going on this year. In fact, I'm racing off to Scotland come May 23rd so that I can just spend a little downtime of my own.
Right. When you walk into our local bookstore, the book that's out front right now is The Bear Sat on My Porch Today. And so I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about that one, because, I mean, the illustrations and the colors are vibrant, but at its heart, this is kind of a rural book in some ways, because it seems to me that, you know, lots of people who are listening right now living in South Dakota are pretty familiar with animals who show up on your front porch, not always sure what to do about them. Tell us where this idea came from, because it's
I got a letter, an email from one of my granddaughters who was house sitting for me when I was in Scotland, probably about 6, 7, 8 years ago, and said, "Nana, I didn't see it, but the neighbor said that there was a bear on your porch today, and it wouldn't go away." And I went, "You've just handed me a picture book."
Right. Thank you very much.
But we call it the kingdom, animal kingdom, not animal kingdom. What is it? Out back, we have bears, we have deer, we have foxes, we have coyotes, we have rabbits, we have bobcats, we have turkeys, and we have turkey vultures. We've got an occasional eagle. We've got hawks. I mean, you name it. Oh, we've got raccoons. We've got skunks. We've got opossums. I love the opossums. I had one right by my door on my deck. I opened the deck door, and it went, boom, I'm dead. And his tongue was sticking out, and it was awful teeth. And I went, "You're not dead. I know you're not dead." "No," he said, with his tongue out, and he opened one eye. "I'm dead." And then I went back in, and he got up and lumbered and walked off. I think they are so hysterical, because what kind of a life style is that? You really think that the other animals are fooled when you fall over? not if they're predators, and not if they're carrion eaters.
You're not impressed.
I'm not impressed. Not at all.
And it reminds me, I think a lot of people also remember you for Owl Moon and the rural nature of that. So when we talk about diversity in picture books, one of the things, people from South Dakota are looking for is something that reflects their lives and their spaces and their worlds. And these are two books that really do that. Is that just because it reflects your life, or are you intentionally looking at it? You look at so many different stories from so many different cultural backgrounds.
Well, let me tell you, I'm a born New Yorker.
Yeah.
I lived until I was 14. My parents and my brother and I lived on 97th Street in Central Park West, across from Central Park, where I thought baseball players and buses, that's it.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was any such thing as nature. Those little green things that were trying to come up between
sidewalk cracks.
The sidewalk cracks did not count.
Right.
All right. And then I met and married the most wonderful man who had been brought up in the mountains of West Virginia. Mm. His parents were teachers, and he lived, he hunted, he trapped, he kept, much to his mother's horror, a snake in a terrarium.
Yeah.
He knew the name of every bird that flew. He knew the name of every animal he saw. He knew the names of the various snakes. I won't get close enough to them to know. He knew all of that stuff. And when we got married, I began to learn it.
Mm.
We moved to the country. We're in a Western Massachusetts farm community. Here have been for the last 50 years. And he taught us all, me and the three children, how to bird.
Hmm.
And our favorite thing to do in the world is go out, he's gone now, unfortunately. He's been dead 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
But was to go on what we call serendipity trips, where we'd drive out into the countryside, get out and walk, with every single person in the family had, their own field glasses. We had our books of trails. We had our books of birds. We had our field guides to tracks. We had all that stuff. And we would just walk. We'd drive to another place. We'd get out, and we'd walk and find a stream and go wading in or body surfing in the stream. I mean, we raised our children that way. But I was raised, as a city kid who became a born-again New Englander.
And now you have another book coming out soon, Come Fly With Me?
Yeah, which just fly with me.
Fly with me. Okay, with birds, right?
I haven't seen with birds, yeah. And all of my children wrote it with me. So that was a great, lovely thing.
You've talked about your writing process before, or really your idea gathering process, with this notion of, you know, seeing something or reading something or overhearing something and just saying, I have to tell somebody this, I have to tell someone this. And, you know, reaching out to a friend or an editor or your kids and saying, does this, you know, is it just me? Or is this really interesting? And that seems to me very childlike in its nature. You've never lost that part of childhood where everything around you is fascinating. You can't wait to tell somebody. Does that describe you still?
That absolutely describes me. I mean, when I teach, and I teach writing a lot, I take my students out on, I mean, my students are grown-ups and they are people who have already sold books, so mm-hmm. we're working on their second career. But I say, if you don't go out your door and find, you know, five new ideas by the time you get back home, you're not trying. Because the ideas are there. They're everywhere. It's only when, you know, you open up your eyes, you let the sounds in, you are willing to walk about and see things and hear things and be silent and take it in. But they're there. I mean, a week when I don't come up with a whole bunch of ideas, they may not all become anything. But it's what you do with the ideas that's important. But a week that I don't come up with between 5 and 10 new ideas is a bad week. I'm probably in the hospital.
Oh my. You have written so much, so many folk tales and fairy tales and stories of, you know, girls doing amazing things and boys doing amazing things. You know, you are one of the leading world scholars on folktale collection and retelling.
Well, I'm not a scholar on that, actually. I don't have any degrees in that, but I've read a lot.
Yeah. You're a keeper of the stories, though, in some way, would you say?
Yeah.
How do you sort of see yourself, you know, at this point, after spending decades of really, you know, reading and retelling and sharing and finding these stories, do you see yourself as a keeper of them?
When people ask me what I do, I kind of shrug and say I write, but I, when I'm absolutely identifying myself, I say I'm a storyteller.
Right.
I'm also a poet, and I think that the poetry informs my stories because my stories tend to sound like long poems.
Right.
It's easier to do when it's a picture book, but I also do it with the novels as well.
You have a novel coming out in verse. Tell me about that. It's your first one, right?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people have been doing novels in verse, and I've resisted because most of the novel and verses that I've read aren't really poems. They're mm-hmm. just really sort of broken prose. And I didn't want to do that unless I could write a book that was entirely in individual poems that told the story. But that they had to be poems. They didn't have to rhyme. That would be deadly.
Mm-hmm.
A whole, you know, novel in rhyme. I think I'd shoot myself. But to tell the story metaphorically, with lyrical language, with the precision that a poem is, I mean, really, it is a precision machine and a metaphor machine. That's what I wanted to do, but I didn't think about writing it, but I was writing some poems about my greatest culture hero. When I was younger, my culture hero was King Arthur.
Mm.
And my brother and my best friend and I, my best friend girlfriend and I, would be out in Central Park. We were playing King Arthur. And I was always King Arthur. I didn't want to be Guinevere. She didn't do anything. You know, I didn't want to be the Lady of Shalott or the Lady in the Lake. They were drips. I wanted to be King Arthur. And he was my culture hero. Right. He had everything. He was heroic. He was honorable. He was loyal. He had a great idea, a scheme of the shining city. He was all that stuff. But as I got older, my culture hero became Baba Yaga,
mm-hmm.
the great Russian witch.
Mm-hmm.
She is anarchic. She does what she wants to do. She takes no garbage from anybody. She's just power, and power from nature, because she has her own gardens, and she, you know. So I started writing poems about her, some of which, you know, I sent out to magazines and journals and that sort of thing. And all of a sudden, one day, I realized I had all these poems, but I didn't want to put them in a collection because they were telling a story.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, well, I'm telling Baba Yaga's story, but how do I get an everyday kid into this story? And isn't that dangerous? And why would the kid stay? And all of those questions started roaming around my brain, and I suddenly had a character, a problem, a girl who runs away from an abusive home, two Baba Yagas, and Baba Yaga likes her because she had done something to free herself. The girl had done something to free herself from difficulties. She was a kid who would work hard, who learned stuff, and over the whole arc of the book, the two of them become kind of quasi mother and daughter.
Hmm.
And in the end, Baba Yaga says to her, "Someday you will be the Baba."
That's powerful stuff.
Yeah. But it came it was one of those things that came very organically. I was not planning it.
Yeah.
It happened. And, you know, in writing, there are two kinds of writers, and teachers make a big mistake when they try to have everyone in the class do the same thing.
Right.
Which is, we're going to write a story today or a poem or whatever. First, you make an outline. Oh, my gosh, I've never made an outline in my life.
Yeah.
Because an outline is a straitjacket. You need to let things flow until they come together. At least I need to do that. Other people, they can make all the outlines they want. They can write the books that they want. I can't do that. So these two kinds of people are known as outliners, and now they're called, the other people like me are called pantsers. Because we're flying by the seat of our pants.
I'm a
like
pantser.
To call us flying into the mist.
Oh, thank you. That's
it's much
nicer.
Yes,
flying, that's me.
Yep. So it doesn't mean either way is better. It just means that in your classroom, you're going to have two different kinds of kids. Don't treat them the same.
Yeah. What kind of books do kids need right now? What do, in a digital age, what kind of books need to be put in their hands? What do you look for?
I would ask the kids what they want.
All right.
And then go from there. I remember at one point I was what we called at my children's elementary school, I was the paperback librarian. I wasn't a librarian, but I would come every 2 weeks with a huge box of paperback books for any of the age groups. It was a K through 6. No, it was no K. It was 1 through 6 was the school. And at the first time, I brought enough for books for every single child in the school. And they all took a book. They didn't even know. Half of them just reached in and took a book. The next time I came, you could keep that book. You could trade that book. And half of them traded, and half wanted to keep the book they had. And there was one little boy whose teacher told me he was fascinated with World War II planes and World War II armaments and Nazi paraphernalia and all this sort of thing. By the end of the year, I had steered him into reading a separate piece.
Oh, wow.
Still World War II.
Right.
But it was a totally different kind of book. And that's a magic that can sometimes happen.
I want to respect your time. And I know you have much to do, so I want to say thank you from so many South Dakota teachers and children, and thank you personally. On a personal note, it's been your books, on the Pirate Queens and the wonderful girl stories and all the fairy tales and folk tales that have just helped me raise my child.
Oh,
so
thank you.
Thank you so much, Danielle.
My pleasure.